We're looking at Philippians 2. Think about what we've seen in Philippians so far. After Paul's introduction, in which he told of his thanking God for them and the things he was praying for them, he focused on himself. He focused on his circumstances in prison and the possible outcome of those, whether it be life or death, and how he viewed those things. Then he turned to focus on them. He focused on their progress and particularly emphasized the need for their unity, their striving together with one heart and mind for the gospel. He talked about the need to be united with no selfishness and no pride. And he used Jesus as an illustration. Jesus who emptied himself and who humbled himself and who just did amazing things to save us. And then God highly exalted him because God chose to exalt the most, the one who had humbled himself the most to save us. And so he's used Jesus as an illustration to try to help them have the right attitude toward one another, to help them to be unselfish and humble. Now he makes some direct exhortations toward them. He says in verse 12, Philippians 2:12, "So then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure." Now, as he commands them, exhorts them to obey, that connects back up to 2:8, where he speaks of Jesus becoming obedient to the point of death. Jesus obeyed, they are to obey. Now, he's not saying that as some sort of a new thing. He says, just as you have always obeyed. So he's giving them actually a compliment here. He's saying, you've been obedient. He recognizes that obedience has characterized them, and he wants them to keep obeying just like they've been doing. Sometimes it's appropriate for us to encourage people to keep doing well. You know, that's the danger is we start out like jackrabbits and then we just, you know, go astray and give up. So he said, I want you to keep obeying. And he says, you obeyed in my presence, but you should obey even more in my absence. You know how sometimes people are, work hard when the boss is looking and slough off when he's not, you know, behave well when the teacher's in the room and start throwing paper wads or whatever they do these days when they're not, and things like that. Well, I think Paul senses some concern about that. It's easy for us to do well, to behave properly when there's a Christian we respect that's seeing us, that's watching us. When Paul was there in Philippi, you know, everybody was toeing the line, everybody was obedient. He said, really, you ought to even more in my absence. There's even greater zeal and care needed when Paul wasn't there to make sure that even without his help and maybe his vigilance to warn them or to correct them, that they don't have that blessing. They need to be sure they're being obedient. The way of obedience is not necessarily easy. You know, pleasure seekers are always looking for an easier way. Religious tourists try to take shortcuts. You know, it's easy for us not to really want to obey because some of the things God commands aren't things we necessarily enjoy. And you know, we like to have fun and we don't like things that are more difficult, and it's really hard for us to want to do what somebody else tells us. But often obedience is the real question in our life. I mean, a lot of serving God depends on obeying. Now, sometimes we say, and appropriately so, that, you know, we ought not just to obey only because we have to. We ought to obey because we want to, but we need to kind of clarify that a little bit. You know, there are things that God commands us to do that we don't enjoy, that are not what we would have chosen. Now, we still obey them joyfully because we love God and we want to please Him and we trust that His way is best. But we sort of have to make ourselves do the right thing. I think about Jesus. When He said to the Father, "Let this cup pass from me, nevertheless not my will but your will be done." I don't think Jesus was excited about the prospect of dying on the cross. I don't think that was something He thought, "Wow, I'll just love that. Every minute of it will be wonderful." He was asking God, "If there's another way, please arrange that." But he respected and loved His Father so much that He says, "Your will be done." That's what we do. You know, there are things that God asks us to obey that we don't like to obey. That are not things we just think, "Wow, this is so much fun." But we obey because we want God's will to be done in us. Because we love God, we trust God, we respect God, and He's told us to do this, so we're going to do it. Because it's a matter of just, that's what He says. That's what obedience involves. Obedience is tested when I really don't want to do it. That's when it's tested. It's not much of a test when somebody tells you to do the very thing you wanted to do anyway. That doesn't prove you're obeying, but it sure proves you're obeying when that wouldn't have been your will, but because it's God's will, that's what you'll do. And so that's what Paul is saying. You know, just as you've always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. That's an interesting thing he'd say, to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. As opposed to overconfidence, complacency, pride, unconcern. Think about Matthew chapter 26 when Jesus told Peter and the other disciples that they would all fall away because of me this night. That's Matthew 26, 31. And Peter said to him in 33, "Even though all may fall away because of you, I will never fall away." Jesus said to him, "Truly I say to you that this very night before a rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Peter said to him, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." All the disciples said the same thing too. There's no fear and trembling there. There's no understanding of the danger. There's overconfidence. You know how it is when you tell a young person, you know, sometimes when they're a child or whatever, and you say, now be careful, you know, that could hurt you. "Oh, no, I'm fine. I know what I'm doing." You know, and we kind of, if it's not too serious, we kind of chuckle. Yeah, because, I mean, we realize, no, they don't. You know, that warning was really worth something, and they're just going to have to find out the hard way because they won't take it seriously. We must not do that with the Lord. His warnings we've got to take to heart. There is danger. And this overconfidence, "Oh, I've got this down. You know, I'm fine." Well, we're just setting ourselves up for a trap. Amos 6 warns those who were at ease in Zion. You know, sometimes we become so comfortable. We just, you know, I've got this Christian thing down. I know what I'm doing. Everything's going great. We've not even understood sometimes the seriousness of what we're doing. We're dealing with the God of heaven. That one day we're going to meet in judgment. So we take this very seriously. We don't take it lightly. There's no carelessness. There are very serious issues that we're dealing with. And so we can't just be lighthearted about our service to God. He says, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. You know, you take this seriously, you'll be very concerned about obeying. And that ought to make us all sober up and think about, what about my life? And are there some things that I ought to be obeying that I've just kind of been laughing off and thinking, well, it doesn't matter that much. Now, he says, "For it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure." God's trying to do something with us, make something out of us. You know, he's trying to finish the job he started with us. And that ought to motivate us to obey him because we don't want to frustrate his project. It's almost like God was trying to, make some wonderful sculpture or some great masterpiece in painting or something. And if we come along and we're not submissive and cooperative, God's not going to be able to complete the work he's doing in us. He's not going to be able to make his masterpiece. If we were just dealing with a matter of what some person was doing, maybe it wouldn't matter so much if we were careless, if we messed things up. But God is working in us. That ought to make us really be serious about it. Do you want to destroy? Do you want to mar the work the Lord God is doing in your life? This is, again, I think sometimes spiritual issues are just a lot more serious than we give them credit for. You know, we try to kind of live a halfway decent life and come to church most of the time and we think I'm doing great. But God's doing more in us than that. At least he's trying to. Now, it also encourages us to know that God's the one who's at work in us, both to will and to work for his good pleasure, because it means that God is not leaving us by ourselves to do this without his help. He is actually working in us. The power that raises dead, that raises the dead lives in us. God makes us able to want and to accomplish what he asks us to do. We can work out our salvation because God is working in us. You know, sometimes when we say, work out your own salvation, we may feel overwhelmed. Well, how could I do that? I'm not good enough, capable enough, strong enough. Well, it's not just us. God is working in us. He will help us. He does enable us. And so that's a serious matter. Don't mess up what God's doing, but it's also an encouraging thing. If we will submit to him, if we'll obey him, if we'll live for him, he will accomplish his purpose in us. We can count on that, and we can be encouraged by that. Do all things, he says in verse 14, without grumbling or disputing. Maybe that fits in with passages like 127 and 2:2 that encourages their unity, their striving together. Passages where he kept saying, you all, like he wants them to join together and work together, even when he talked in chapter 4 about those two women who weren't getting along. Grumbling and disputing is what we do when we're not very patient with each other, when we want to get our own way, when we're frustrated, when we feel sorry for ourselves, and we feel like we're not being treated right, we're not being treated fair, and I don't like what's going on around me. We become grumblers and disputers. Do you remember the Israelites when they left Egypt? It had been bad for them in Egypt. Severe slavery, oppressive. Pharaoh was a tyrant, and they were forced to do all this hard labor, and they were crying out. And God miraculously delivered them the plagues, the crossing of the Red Sea, provides for them in the desert. And what do they start doing? Grumbling and disputing. You know, because it wasn't just what they wanted. It was a long ways. Sometimes it wasn't water. It was just monotonous food. Same manna every day. And all that kind of stuff. And instead of being grateful for their blessings and thinking about all God had done, what did they think about? I don't like this. I don't like that. I don't like the other thing. And we do that in our relationships with each other. We quarrel when we don't agree about something. We complain and are frustrated when somebody doesn't treat us the way that we think they ought to. when we feel like it's just not fair. And we do it against God when we feel like life's just not fair and He's just not doing what He ought to do. Instead of counting our blessings, we complain about everything we think in the way it ought to be. Now, did you notice what he said? Do all things without grumbling or disputing? He didn't leave us a lot of wiggle room there, did he? Well, some things you can do with grumbling and disputing, just not everything. No, he says do all things without grumbling and disputing. Someone has said, you may not be able to exist without sin, but you can exist without grumbling. You know, we can stop that. We can be appreciative for our blessings. I think that's a hard issue. And every time we start feeling sorry for ourselves, we're setting ourselves up to fall into sin because we justify ourselves in our mind. Poor me, look at all I'm going through. That's not right. Now look at what he continues to say in verse 15. So that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world. Now think about the command to be blameless and innocent and above reproach. God wants us to really be righteous, to really do what He wants us to do. And He says that we shine as lights in the world. We're in the middle of a crooked and perverse generation, but He wants us to shine brightly in the world of darkness. Isaiah 42:6, I am the Lord, I've called you in righteousness, I will also hold you by the hand and watch over you, and I will appoint you as a covenant to the peoples, as a light to the nations. And in Isaiah 49 and verse 6, he says a very similar thing. He says, it's too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved ones of Israel. I will also make you a light of the nations so that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. That's talking in initial application about Jesus. But Acts 13 uses that to talk about us as followers of Jesus. We are also supposed to be a light to the nations. We are supposed to be a light in the midst of darkness, shining the light of righteousness and truth and honesty and purity in a dark world. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. That's Daniel 12:3. We don't read Daniel 12 very often, but that's a great verse. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. That's our goal, is to shine brightly in the world of darkness and to lead many to the Lord in that way. In Matthew 13:43, then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. That's the goal, is that we shine like the sun, that we're lights gleaming brightly in the vast darkness of the night sky. But you think about it. I mean, that's a challenge. Our tendency is to want to kind of blend in with the darkness, to kind of be sort of shades of gray. Sometimes we don't like standing out. We don't like being that different. It makes us feel awkward. We get rejected. The darkness sure doesn't like the light. It's going to do everything it can to put the quietus on the light. So that's what he wants us to be, lights in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory because I did not run in vain nor toil in vain. There is a debate about that term, holding fast. Some people think it means hold forth. I think it's probably better to take it as hold fast. As we are shining as lights, we hold fast to the word of life. We stick with it. The word, the truth of the Bible is such an important thing to help us to be lights, to be innocent and pure and righteous people in the world. So hang on to the word of life So that in the day of Christ, Paul will be happy that he had not worked in vain. There is so much in Philippians about the day of Christ. Back in chapter 1 and verse 6, he said, "He who began a good work in you will perfect it until the day of Christ." In 1:10, he says, "To be sincere and blameless until the day of Christ." Here, "Hold fast so that in the day of Christ, I'll have done something worthwhile." Our life is to be lived in view of the day of Christ. And that's really what gives meaning and purpose to our Christian life. We are living for the day of Christ. That's the day all of us will appear at. We'll all be there. And we'll all give an account. And that's that. Everybody that's ever lived will be there. And Paul wants to be able, in the day of Christ, say, "My work with the Philippians was not in vain. They endured, they were faithful, they held fast the word of life, and what a blessing if his work would not have been fruitless in that day of life." And then, the day of Christ, and then in verse 17, Paul talks about himself in connection with the Philippians for a moment. He says, "But even if I am being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. You too, I urge you, rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me." It was common in the Old Testament when a sacrificial animal was offered to pour out the drink offering on the animal. It was common also to have a grain offering. At the same time, it was like giving a complete meal to God. You've got the meat, the bread, and the drink. And the drink offering then was almost always an accompanying offering. They called that a libation. That's kind of a technical term. But it accompanied the main offering, which was the animal. Now, Paul is seeing them as the main offering. Their lives are the principal sacrifice to God. And he is the libation. He's the drink offering completing that sacrifice. Now, I think it's interesting Paul doesn't see himself as being the main feature. He's not showing himself as the main sacrifice. He's the accompanying drink offering. Sometimes we think we're the centerpiece of everything that's being offered to God, and we should not think that way. We should seek to bless the offering of others to the Lord. But I love that idea. He's being poured out as a drink offering. What do you pour out? Well, in this case, it's a liquid. And I think that gives the idea of his just expending himself totally for the service of others. You know, he's pouring himself out to be a blessing to them. Are we willing to pour ourselves out, to lay our lives down, to give ourselves, to bless the people that God has entrusted us to be around? That was a great blessing to Paul. Paul would do whatever it took. He'd pour himself out in any way to complete their service, the sacrifice and service of their faith, and he rejoiced to be able to do that. He rejoiced to be able to help his brethren regardless of the personal cost. That's amazing. And you know from thinking about Paul's life, this was not an empty statement. Paul really had poured himself out in every sacrificial way to serve his brethren. And Paul did rejoice to be able to do that. What a goal for us, to pour ourselves out, to bless other people as they serve God in faith. What you see so much in this book is this idea of our unity and our unselfish, humble attitude toward each other. Jesus is an example of that. He emptied himself. He humbled himself. Now, Paul's an example of that. He pours himself out on the sacrifice and service of their faith. What a joy to be able to do that. I think this world has never gotten any clue as to what gives joy. We do all these things that we think are going to make us happy, and we're more and more miserable and depressed. The thing that will give us true joy is pouring ourselves out to serve our brethren. We're going to reread this passage and then we'll stand and sing. So then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory, because I did not run in vain nor toil in vain. But even if I am being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. You too, I urge you, rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me. Let's stand and sing.